Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the tire.
Hi, and welcome to Brain Healthy with myself, Jessica Aaronworth. I'm so extremely honored to have Rick Goodwin joining me in the studio today. Rick is the founder of Men and Healing. They can be found at menandhealing.ca. And for nearly 20 years, he has built and was past executive director of the Men's Project in Ottawa. He has received his master's in social work, and he has trained clinically in a variety of models, focusing primarily on engagement in trauma recovery, ending men's violence, and human sexuality. He has provided training in three continents and is internationally recognized in his work on male-centered approaches to therapy. And I am so excited because Rick has promised to share his insights with us today about trauma, men, and healing. So we are going to be talking about what he has learned over the course of his career and how he implements his learning into valuable strategies and action steps when working with clients, and how you can use some of these valuable strategies, action steps, and information with your own clients. Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite fine.
Good. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good to be here.
So tell me a bit about, you have had like a really extensive career with so many interesting twists and turns. Can you tell me a bit about yourself and your career?
Well, that's a wide open question, though. I don't know where even to begin on that. In my formative years, I did an undergraduate in psychology, and while I found psychology to be very interesting, I also had a big question about where does it all, fit? Where does it all take place in the broader social scheme? And in that regard, I think when I shifted from psychology to social work, I found a bit more of my calling in terms of putting theory into practice or putting ideas into helping create change in the world. And in my master's years, I was also challenged, I think, a bit being a guy in what has stereotypically been a women-centered profession. And examining questions as to, what is my role, or what is men's role in this broader effort of social change. And I think at that time, certainly getting to the questions posed in my student years about my work.
I think we are having some technical difficulties. Rick, are you there?
I am here.
You know what? Can we have you phone in through your phone? Because we're having some issues. It's cutting in and out, and we can't hear a word you're saying.
Okay, I got the phone number. I'll call right now.
Thank you. This is the great part of doing live radio. You never know what is going to happen and what's going to happen next. And Rick has so much amazing information for us that I really want him to be able to share this without cutting out, because he is really amazing at what he does and knows so much about men and healing. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
Okay,
how's
that's much
across?
Better.
Good, good. All right.
So you were
asking Jessica, and I don't know what part you may have heard, or maybe you didn't hear anything I said.
Yeah, it really kept on cutting out, so I didn't hear a lot.
Okay.
Can you start at the beginning
again?
Actually, and
well, should we take it from the top?
I was finding it really interesting that you were talking about being a man in a profession where there's so many women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's true. Social work is, you know, still primarily, you know, classrooms. You'll see 75% plus women in there. So it's an interesting gendered learning experience, you know, primarily being in the minority, i.e. being a man, and also examining many issues of gender, whether it be you know, domestic violence, whether it be sexual assault. I mean, these were big themes that were being discussed back in the early mid-80s when I went through my training. And again, some pretty hard questions were being asked of men in general, and particularly of men in the program. So I think that really whet my appetite, both in terms of merging my interest in social change, my inherent interest in psychology, and, you know, as it's applied into the therapeutic process. And again, trying to find a role for myself that seemed to speak to a broader interest, a broader vision. And so hence I have spent most of my career focusing on issues pertaining to men. The first number of years after my master's really came out of my master's research was an intervention program for men who would be assaultive in relationships. And that led to an initiative that's still running here in Ottawa to work with men who are, you know, have been charged, have been convicted of domestic assault. And that was certainly an experience that cut my teeth on working these different angles of social change. I did that from about 85 to 1990 before I think I burned out badly and got out of that work, and I moved into teaching. Teaching primarily at that time in an Aboriginal context within Aboriginal social service programs, always holding, though, this notions of gender and approaches to change, approaches to anti-violence work. And I think all that was really important learning for me, both the teaching as well as the anti-violence work, to continue my work clinically with men.
And your work has been, I've actually been following your work for quite a few years. I've done a lot of work myself in the anger management realm here in Toronto, and really came across your work on the internet while searching for other programs that were doing similar things that my company at the time was doing. You went the way of setting up a not-for-profit program, which I've always found very interesting and fascinating. Can you tell us the
merits and demerits of going the non-profit route in terms of service provision? I'm not too sure if I would have changed that to go back into time, but you know, both realms of service can be their own private hell in many respects, too. What we were never able to achieve at the Men's Project, and perhaps never able to achieve, I think, in the nonprofit, you know, / charity world, is to evolve to a place of being not dependent on government. So while we started up before we received government funding, it was only with provincial funding that we were able to live as long as we did, which was about 17 years. And, you know, the agency wrapped up when the provincial government decided not to fund the services any longer. And I think that's the, you know, that is the bitter reality for many, many nonprofits. Unless you've got an issue that could be captured in the, you know, in the public sway, an issue that, you know, people will gladly donate funds for, you know, you can't get away from that dependency. And I think that became the death knell of the organization.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll say it out loud. I'll probably have many people hating on me for making this comment, but the truth of the matter is that there's not a lot of funding for men's initiatives or men's issues these days, and most of the funding really goes towards women's initiatives and women's issues, which, as fantastic as that may be, I really believe that violence in the community, violence against women, violence against men, anger in general, mental health, those are human issues. And when we relegate them to being male or female, I think that gets us into a lot of trouble. You know, I know when I started working in the anger management sector, I've always worked in for-profit private practice. And I remember my first job in a private practice for anger management. And I remember going to my supervisor and saying, you know, something's not making sense because the stories that I'm hearing are not necessarily aligning with what's brought people in. And I'm hearing, you know, so many stories from so many people, both men and women, about how the system has been abused. I've heard stories about, you know, from men who have gone home and asked for a divorce and have ended up in jail that night. I've heard stories from women who have been abused for years and years and years and finally got the courage to reach for that phone, having it yanked out, and the women that were arrested instead of the male because the phone call was placed by the male and not the woman. And I think when we talk about this system, we're really looking at human issues. And it's a shame that I hate the fact that the center went under. And there wasn't any funding for that because I think no matter what side you stand on, that's a real unjust to our world and our society.
Well, you know, I can't argue with the thing you say, Jessica. I think, you know, our experience here with the Men's Project, I mean, we're obviously all within a broader, we live in a broader society that believes in the masculinization of perpetration. Meaning that when we look at offending behavior, that stereotypically we think of the male offender, and stereotypically this is the bias, the lens that we use to understand that. We also live in the feminization of victimhood. So even after 16, 18 years of existence, we were never able, as a men's sexual abuse, sexual assault center, to realize the same funding stature of the other 36 sexual assault centers in the province, because those were all created with respect to women as victims. We were the only male-centered agency in the province of Ontario, and, of course, it's no longer existing. So I think, you know, despite best efforts, we were never able to break out of that, or maybe as a society, we never were able to evolve out of that gendered way of thinking. You know, and this is despite, you know, relative progress, certainly on the research front, knowing that these issues are not black and white. The bias is still inherently there, and, of course, it's always reflected in the funding streams. I could go on further, but, you know, provincial matters, but I don't think Ontario is an isolated matter in this regard.
No, I agree with you. I don't think it is. I think that's why I say it really is. It's a world problem. It's a human problem. It's a global problem. It's, you know, the health and well-being of our society worldwide is so important. Each country does not live as really we're seeing in world events now, each country does not live in isolation. We live with every other country in this world. And I really think that something has to change, because we have to start looking at things as global issues, as human issues, more than what I've seen done. And if I'm missing something, please let me know. I'd love to have that conversation and learn more about it.
Well, it's a challenge, and that challenge, I think, is going to continue. And we certainly have lots of evidence to suggest that the bias is continuing. I just think of a couple things from recent news. Canada's efforts to bring in refugees from Syria. We know that single men are not welcomed into the country. Other populations, families, women, children, are welcome, but not single men. And there wasn't an uproar about that practice. I think we're seeing the advent now of the inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. And we look at that issue. Why are men excluded from that? It isn't like there's any difference in the homicide rate or the ratio of homicides between men and women in Aboriginal communities, just like there is that same ratio in non-Aboriginal communities. But we, again, don't see the uproar on that. So we still have lots of work to do on this, that's for sure.
I totally agree. So I'm gonna shift the conversation a bit so we don't go into a total political show, because I'm sure we can. I have lots to say about different issues, and I'm sure you do. Before I do that, for everyone listening in, if you have any questions for either myself or Rick, please feel free to call us. You can call us at 646-716-7979, and we would be happy and thrilled to take your questions. Rick, one of the big debates that I hear from a lot of practitioners is to whether to go for that not-for-profit stream or private practice profit stream. Can you give us some of the pros and cons for each, since you really have experience in each?
Well, certainly the going the non-profit route opens the service up to what's available in terms of government funding, whether that be federally or provincially or locally, or through, say, private foundations. Essentially, no government services will consider funding towards a private entity. So, again, that opens up a world of potential. Now, that funding pot, that collective funding pot, is constricting. It is not growing, certainly. And as we see the social safety net wither in this country, you also have to keep in mind that there are many, many charities already in existence. And in some ways, they can act as a kind of cartel in terms of, do they leave a chair open, at the table for a new entity? Generally not. Private charity work, nonprofit work, it kind of belies the public image of it, but it's very competitive, it's very cutthroat, and there is not generally space made for newcomers at the table. So even though you may see lots of funding dollars, whether they're already spoken of or whether you can actually get a shot at engagement, that's another thing. Some funding entities are moving towards having less, supporting less charities. So they're pushing towards amalgamation of services. Well, I mean, there could be real cost benefits for amalgamation of services, but going to see less diversity in those services. You're going to see less innovation because, again, they will only be working with the bigger corporations, the bigger nonprofits that that take on the work. So this is hard. These are hard barriers, say, for what, crazy enough to say, you know, it's innovative work to work with men. Working with men was seen as a real outlier of an issue. It certainly wasn't, you know, warmly welcomed as a concept. I think, you know, women's organizations, you know, rightly or wrongly, were defensive, were fearful possibly about where, if funding goes toward services for men, is that coming out of the pocket of funding for services for women? So, you know, there's lots of shadow material there in terms of trying to create something in the nonprofit world. On a different level, there's somewhat some ease at creating a private structure. You know, you find a space, you open the doors, and you spread the good word of the new service. You don't have to deal with bylaws and, you know, provincial or federal incorporation and doing your charity audit and, you know, submission to CRA each year. You don't have a board of directors who may or may not be in keeping with the operations of the organization. And, you know, this is also another kind of not terribly publicized aspect of charities, which is the inherent tensions between the board of directors and the operations. You'd like to think they're all in sync. If you've got a charity that does food bank work, you'd like to think that the board of directors supports the efforts of the staff called operations and providing food for those who are in need. Well, sometimes they don't get along, those two parties. Sometimes their interests are inherently different. And this, again, is part of that shadow of the nonprofit world. You don't really have that in a private structure. You know, if you're working as a group, you get like-minded people and you work together. If one person doesn't agree, well, they may have to put up the decision, or maybe they'll walk and they create something else. It's not as much of a structure or a labyrinth of structures as a nonprofit is. Could we have done what we wanted to do with the Men's Project if it was a private entity? I would say no, not at all. Perhaps one of our most significant pieces of work is that we had official standing at the Cornwall Public Inquiry. Well, we could only have done that as a nonprofit. And through that standing at the Cornwall Inquiry, you know, we did make recommendations about services, not just in Cornwall, but services province-wide. And some of those recommendations were supported at the end of the day by Commissioner Gload. That input into public policy would not have occurred in any private arrangement. So I think, to answer your question, it really depends on what your interests are. If your interests are just to provide good clinical care for, you know, a group of clients that you could attend to each week, well, there's no point in going the nonprofit route. If you're looking at something broader in terms of social movement, social policy, changing the way the world works, then you pretty well have to consider the nonprofit route for that sense of recognition or as an unbiased authority. So yeah, it's a tough question.
Yeah, it is. Do you think within private practice it can gain enough momentum to start, you know, to start shifting how the world works?
Well, not to diminish what each one of us can do to make the world a better place. So if you're a private practitioner and you've got, say, 20 clients a week, I mean, you're making a substantial shift in those lives of those people, and those people have people in their lives, you know, and the ripples go outward. There's no doubt about that. It's hard to think, though, of a private practice approach that would be broader in terms of social change, that would affect the lives of people that have no connection to the original source of those ripples, being the actual practice area. And in that sense, I know that some of the work and some of the research and publications that we have done over the years under the charity, the Men's Project, have been picked up in many countries. Our research that came out of the Cornwall Inquiry was shared. We'd get letters from, you know, a variety of countries in Europe saying, oh, it came across this stuff, and, you know, they're using it to help develop their services in their country or their state. And, I mean, that's really interesting. I mean, it was fascinating to watch, and it felt good. It made the sense that the hard work was not just of the local benefit, but, you know, the ripples went out there. I don't think we would have gotten that traction internationally if it was just a publication by a practitioner. I think by making it a community initiative and then, you know, part of a broader social change, you know, dare say movement, and I'm not even too sure if it is a movement, but at least it's an emerging sector, being men's services, I think there is a possibility of changing the broader world.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I always say only together can we heal the world, because there is strength in numbers, and I think creating social movement, social change really comes from banding together as healers, professionals, therapists, coaches, wellness practitioners of all sorts, and really gaining momentum together, which is what Brain Healthy is all about. If anyone has any questions, feel free to call in. You can reach us at 646-716-7979. I believe we do have someone on the line, so let me just check this out. Hello, you're on the line with Rick and Jessica. Do you have a question? Nope, call has been dropped. Okay. If you do have any questions, feel free to give us a call. Again, we're going to shift the conversation. We have many facets of conversation today. There's so much to cover with the wealth of your knowledge, Rick. So for practitioners who are working with men and trauma and healing, what are some things that they can take away? What are some strategies and really action steps that they can take away to help them not necessarily work more effectively, but work with their clients?
Oh, again, another big question. In terms of our training work, we preface almost all our training with some sort of review or summary of what we call male-centered approaches to therapy. And this looks at the inherent challenges of working with men as a client group, some of the unique approaches that could be utilized in doing that work, and also I think in saying all that, the needing to analyze the inherent value set of therapy. And I don't think it's an overstretch to say that psychotherapy as we know it inherently holds values that could well be defined as feminine by nature. It's not a surprise that most practitioners of psychotherapy are women. It's not a surprise that most of the clients of mental health services are women. So, you know, this value set, you know, doesn't come out of nowhere. But, you know, if we take just some very basic values in therapy, disclosure, articulation of emotionality, becoming vulnerable. You know, if you just look at those in themselves, inherently they are in opposition to the dictates of masculinity. You know, men are to be not to disclose. Men are taught to, solve problems on their own, not ask for help. And well, those seem like very basic value shifts. It becomes quite apparent that for some men, for many men to some degree, it's quite a struggle to learn how to do therapy, to see the inherent value of it, to not just sort of see it as an expression of weakness, to ask for help. And, you know, just a basic question, is asking for help a sign of weakness, or is it a strength to be able to ask for help? And that by itself can open up a discussion, certainly amongst men. And they can share in their life of how they have thought one way and have acted another way on that notion of basically asking for help. So I think we've got to look at some of those values inherent in therapy, not to suggest that therapy is useless for guys, it's not, but it may suggest that we've got to be open to different approaches in working with men, because men are not women. And while similar issues may be at play, whether it be trauma, whether it be addiction or depression, the route that the client needs to go through might be, in fact, different. It might be using different language. Some of the kind of basic, classic, male-centered language would be using words like courage and strength and not talking about being a victim and not talking about being vulnerable, you know, even though that the work may need to reflect some of those realities, men respond to some words differently than women. And I think that's, you know, just a very basic but, you know, important way that therapy can look different for guys. We try to incorporate, in terms of our overall therapy style, more action methods of therapy, believing that men are not as comfortable in just the sitting back verbal disclosure that may typify more most therapy. So experiential work, action work, are some of the methods we like to use. Now, you could be a therapist and say, hey, I do experiential and action methods with my women clients and they like it too, and maybe that's just basic good therapy. Still, we've got to keep kind of working through what makes a man's experience to be his own. What is that, you know, broader masculine mores that guys struggle with all their life? And, you know, here we need to look at some of the writings of what's called the new psychology of masculinity, and look at the value sets that are inherent in boys who want, you know, boys learning to become men. So we, you know, look at the foundations of the male code, which, you know, came out in the 70s, which is, you know, that there are four inherent values of masculinity, and they permeate all aspects of life, you know, from being a solitary problem solver to a relationship with aggression and violence, to men's overt concern of hierarchy of social standing, and aspects of opposition to femininity and homosexuality. I mean, these constitute some of the more fundamental aspects of a masculine approach. We need to unearth these with the guys. We need to explore them in a respectful way. We also look at issues of gender role strain, which are, you know, what are the negative aspects of male socialization and how do they come to haunt individual men in their lives. You know, these are some of the aspects that we need to talk about, whether we're going to engage with men as offenders or men as victims or men in any aspect of therapy. So this is kind of the stuff that we get into when we do training on this work.
That sounds great. It's fascinating. We have a question, so I'm going to answer this question. Hi, do you have a question for us?
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I had it's not really a question, it's more of a kind of an experience. I'm a senior in high school, and Rick was saying about the, promoting courage and stuff like that. I work with ESOL kids, ESE kids, and I found that when you promote courage in their life and kind of a I don't know how to explain it, verbal praise, if you will. If you give them more of that, they seem to do more of a good, better job at listening and understanding what you're trying to speak to them. So I felt like that was good. So.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And it's true. I think within everyone, we have so many layers. And once you start peeling back different layers and start really understanding all of our self-talk and all of the things that go on within us, all of our beliefs and values and how we view the world and how we see ourselves in the world, promoting courage in people can be one of the most, I find, the most healing things that you can do.
Yeah.
And I know in my experience, I've had, you know, some really awful teachers who have done the opposite of promoting courage within me and created lifelong struggles and battles within my psyche about it.
Yeah. So I always, when a new kid comes into the slot, because I mean, I work with them a lot, I always try to, you know, get his name and let him know that there's, you know, he's not alone, because I find that, you know, they have it harder, and I just feel like, you know, you need to promote courage with, especially ESE kids, because, you know, it's not that they don't understand, it's more that they're not as, you know, they don't have some of the mindsets that we have, so, you know.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. No, that's great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing with us.
Yeah.
Rick, would you agree with that comment?
Yeah. I mean, I'm, you know, we all respond to praise, you know, men, women, boys, girls. I would suggest that's a universal, but in the style and the manner in which we give praise, I think particularly working with a more vulnerable population like our caller does, and maybe even working with boys in the educational system. And there are some thinkers that believe that our educational system has moved, you know, the pendulum has moved so farther and farther away from speaking to boys' reality, that boys are perhaps more vulnerable in our educational system than girls are. I think particularly given those two factors, the praise and the style of praise is critical. Boys need to feel like they have a place in the school system. And while that seems like an overstatement, we are seeing indicators that boys are doing less well academically. They're moving less on to higher education as a result. We know that a certain percentage of boys are medicated in part to conform to the educational system. You know, all the attention on attention deficit disorders and whatever, which is primarily a boy's diagnosis, not a girl's. I mean, these are formidable barriers for boys' success in the school system. So, yeah, how we engage, when to engage, using language that speaks to their inner reality, this is the stuff that's important.
Yeah, I know. I have three boys, and I know that we struggle, each of them very differently, but we struggle with the school system a lot, every night, actually, when we're trying to do homework.
Sure.
So in terms of communication styles, because I find that really interesting, because, you know, I also come from within a lot of the couple work I do, what we find is that men and women do communicate very differently. So as a therapist, when you are working with men, it's very important to really be aware of bodily cues, and of the style of communication that, that each person uses and addresses. Can you tell, can you talk to us a bit about that?
Well, I mean, it's a generalization, but certainly, you know, one could say that men communicate differently than women. Their nonverbals would be different. As a therapist, the need to focus not just on what is articulated, but what is not. I mean, this would be good fundamental for anyone considering doing couple work, you know, with a heterosexual couple in that regard. At the same time, the critique of couple therapy in terms of men's experiences, I mean, this is something I hear a lot. And, you know, I'll declare my own limitation. I don't offer couple work. However, I do work with men who've experienced couple therapy. Generally speaking, their experience is not a positive one. In some ways that they feel there's some hijacking that goes, that takes place between the therapist and, you know, again, using the heterosexual couple analogy with the wife, with the woman, you know, in part because of the inherent values of therapy, the inherent values of couple therapy speaks much more to a woman's reality. You know, emotional articulateness, opening oneself up, looking at nuance, you know, are not necessarily all standards that that men excel at. And I think that, along with the fact that a lot of couple therapists are women, right from the get-go, there's a, you know, kind of a triangulation between the three parties, with a man feeling in the lesser so of the three places. This is, again, not to say that couple therapy is not useful. It is. It needs to be done competently, like every aspect of the human service work. But we can't dismiss issues of gender from that either. And, again, I just think it's another part of our work collectively that we need to talk about more, study more, and understand the dynamics of more to speak to men's reality in therapy.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although I do find, I know that when I was running the Center for Health and Anger Resolution, which was a company that I co-ran for many, many years, we did have a male therapist on staff, and it was quite surprising how many men requested to have a female therapist rather than a male.
That's also very interesting. And I just want to clarify, Jessica, that in what I'm saying here, you know, I believe that women practitioners can equally excel at working with men as male practitioners. One of the aspects of my years of managing the men's project is we had close to a 50-50 ratio of staff over the years. So it's not really our gender, but how we work. It's our, you know, kind of our genderized mind, our understanding, our analysis, our engagement skills. That's what can make a male-centered therapist, regardless of that person's own gender. I think what you just shared, though, is an interesting observation of therapy as a whole. You know, if we take it in terms of working with trauma survivors, let's say victims of sexual abuse, and we know for men that's, you know, 1 in 6 men have had that experience as children. Their preference over the gender of their therapist has a lot to do with who abused them. So men who were abused as boys by, say, a male offender will inordinately choose female therapists. However, for men who were sexually abused by a woman as a child, when they were children, will prefer a male therapist. And I think what we're also looking at as well is some of the inherent values that we typify therapy as being, our inherent values of femininity. So, you know, maybe not surprising, we all yearn to go to the good mother more so than we yearn to go to the good father, you know, who the therapist represents one or the other of those. You know, it's really intriguing. It's not simple. And yet, if we can understand and get the gist of all what we're talking about here, you know, it could lead to better therapy, better engagement, healthier men, healthier families. Like this is really the core material in many respects.
Yeah, I work with a large section of men. I work with a lot of women too. And so many times in my career, I have been asked, especially, it's interesting, the more I move online and the more things I do online, I'm asked even more, well, do you want to work with men or women? Make a decision. And I don't have an answer to that. I love the human aspect of the work that I do. I love the human aspect of healing in general, of emotional work, of mental health work, of really connecting with people and getting down to the best possible solutions to help. Doing that psychoeducation piece, which really allows people to understand what's going on, why are they getting so angry and flying off the handle and are not able to control it, either too regularly or once is enough, and how can they learn how to do that type of have that type of control over their emotions and understand their emotions, because in our world we don't learn these things. We don't talk about these things. And I think where that discernment is women talk about it more than men, so, which is why women become so much better. Granted that our brains are different as well, the function of our brains and how we communicate and how we like to do things. But women have a lot more practice at expressing their emotions within their inner circles. And not all, but a lot of men's groups or circles stay away from that emotional talk, that emotional dialogue. They keep more surface. That's what I feel. So yeah, it's just, I find it interesting that we try to segment, you know, men versus women, when we all kind of live in this world together.
Well, it also doesn't help that we live, you know, whether province or country, that genderizes services across the board. So if you're a victim of sexual violence, you'll be seen as, you know, there are services there for women. And just in the recently, there's a modicum of services now for men out of the Cornwall Inquiry. However, the issue is still there. There's not a $1 spent in the province of Ontario, but one provincial dollar to address men who are victims of domestic violence. You know, this is a policy that's been set years ago. It continues to be there, which doesn't reflect the reality of what we know of the issue. Whether one is a beginning practitioner, you know, in school, this is the lens that they learn. If we look at focus on the public education messages put out, this is the message that people learn. So it's not surprisingly that, you know, as a field, we're gendered in our thinking in terms of limitation rather than being more expansive or being more humanistic or being more, I'm trying to think of a better word to describe, you know, your position. You know, these are issues that affect everybody. It would be crazy to think of a family, say, as a unit, and okay, these people in the family will be fed, but not these other two because of an aspect of gender. No, that doesn't work. You know, your family feeds everyone. But as a society, we do have slayed that understanding.
Yeah, and when one person, whoever that is having issues, you know, there's nothing more rewarding than working with men and or women, I find nothing more rewarding than coming out of a session and knowing that there has been a difference made in this person's life, knowing that they're walking out of that session thinking more about things that they weren't thinking about before or weren't able to deal with before, and now they are able to deal with a lot more, living drama-free life, learning how to control their temper, learning how to go home, open up, and really love their spouse and their children. And that is what's behind the work that we do. And for anyone, when people start shutting down and don't know how to communicate what's going on or don't even understand what's going on, that's where we run into huge issues. And I think our job is really to help people understand what's going on and give them these tools and strategies to work with so that they can live the life that they really want to live. And for those of you who are looking for tools and strategies for anger in particular, I have a resource website, which is called theangerrevolution.com. And there's some free resources and trainings on that website. Rick, we have about 5 minutes left. Anything you want to say before we close, before we end?
Oh, I mean, there's so much to talk about on this issue, and yet it comes down to the simple core issues that you articulated so well, you know, which is we should be working towards a world that we're opening the door for everyone to come through in terms of social, personal change, finding peace of mind, peace of heart. And in that sense, I think men are kind of the great untapped population, not to focus on in a stigmatizing way, but, you know, in an effort to be creative and re-envision what our services can be, our supports can be, for men. I sometimes feel badly for young men who are in this real struggle as to all the competing notions of their emerging manhood. You know, whether they are drawn to the stereotypes of their fathers, whether they're drawn to the hyper-masculinity that still is quite active and alive and well, or whether they're wishing to reformulate masculinity to fit more within their own sense of self. These are not easy journeys for young men to go through. Youth need mentors. Youth need people to help guide them through those difficult transitions. I'd like to see more effort made on health mentors for young men so that they don't end up in therapy, you know, in their mid-40s after developing a drinking habit or after another failed relationship. Or, you know, more talk of children who are not supported by their fathers, in part because men don't have the right toolbox. We're never given the right toolbox at an earlier age. This is what I think our collective work can help respond to. We know that men who are survivors of sexual abuse, on average, are 45 before they engage in treatment, engage in help. Well, on average, they were sexually abused between the age of 9 and 10. So we're talking about, on average, for the guys who seek help, there's 3.5 decades of suffering. And that suffering is essentially needless. We need to find ways to engage with men more profoundly and at an earlier age to reduce that suffering in their lives, because they suffer, their loved ones suffer, as society we suffer, and at the same time, we can work towards changing that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you know, that's a great show topic: how to raise your boys to be magnificent, healthy men. So we will be doing that show at some point. So stay tuned. Thank you so much for joining me, Rick. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate that you've taken the time to come out and talk to all of us and share your wealth of knowledge.
Well, you are indeed welcome.
And that is it for today's episode of Brain Healthy. If you want to connect with Rick Goodwin, Rick, your website is?
www.menandhealing.ca.
If you want to connect with me, you can reach me at www.brainhealthyclinic.com. Or if you're looking for more resources on anger, stress, and anxiety, please join me at www.theangerrevolution.com. I'll see you two Tuesdays from now for another episode of Brain Healthy.